in the big candy mountains. All the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft boiled eggs.
The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the farmer's trees are full of hay.
Hello, everyone, and I'm Kirk Bankstead. How you doing?
You like that my choice of song there, the Big Rock Candy Mountain for this one from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It was the closest thing I could think of that would involve child labor. It would be something from the Depression era. We'll get to our guest to talk about that in just a moment. First, I want to thank our hosts here at News Talk 92.7, our broadcast home every Wednesday at 7. You can use the Devil Radio app to catch our show or any of the others. On the weekends, you can catch this as a podcast over at upnorthpodcast.com. And as for my day job, I'd invite you to discover Wisconsin's top stories and headlines over at upnorthnewswi.com or search upnorthnewswi on your favorite social media feeds. Sarah?
So, Senate Bill 332 extends the hours that children under the age of 16 are able to work. So, under current state law, children ages 14 and 15 are prohibited from working past 9 p.m. during the summer months and 7 p.m. during the school year. This bill would allow this age group to work until 9:30 on school nights and 11 p.m. otherwise. It doesn't overrule the Fair Labor and Standards Act that is designed to protect children and child labor, which prohibits children from working more than 3 hours on a school day, for example. But if anyone pays attention to local labor habits, those 3 hours usually go over quite often. And so we have a special guest here today to talk to us about what it means to regress on the issue of child labor.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, we're so lucky. For one, we have a professor, Barry Eidlin, who is the assistant professor of sociology at McGill University in Quebec. And he also authored the book Labor and the Class ID in the United States and Canada. Now, before I get further on into this, though, I have to say, you know, although you're from the Harvard of Canada, you do have some bona fides in the state of Wisconsin. Am I correct?
Indeed. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. But yes, after getting my PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, I was fortunate enough to relocate to the Badger State for 2 years when I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Wisconsin. So I really loved my time in Madison. And, you know, I've gone back actually to speak about my book. And so it's great to be able to be addressing the Wisconsin audience again.
Well, you're live in Madison radio right now, but you will be beamed to all of northern Wisconsin this Saturday, so you'll have a much larger audience in podcast form. So thanks again for being here. And normally we don't have other than Pat Kreitlow and Sarah, my two co-hosts, we generally don't have such smart hosts or guests on the show.
Oh, bless your heart. get to your question already.
Okay. So obviously child labor is what we're talking about, but I think we don't have to kind of belabor the fact that this is a bad policy that has kind of been just kind of trumped up, to deal with a real issue, which is a tight labor market. And so I wanted to, you know, talk about, you know, ways that, you know, that we can relieve a tight labor market. But before that, because, you know, you've written a book about the labor, you know, the labor market, unions and in history, I wanted to, you know, kind of even go back and just have you kind of lay the groundwork on when in American history has the average laborer had enough, you know, had the purchasing power to actually live a life that is not underwater and scary for them, you know, and has that correlated with, you know, the rise and the fall or the rise of the labor movement? Oh, I just wanted to kind of get some historical background before we jump into some policy stuff.
Yeah, I thought you were going to ask about the history of child labor. which I could talk about. But I mean, I guess the short answer is that, you know, in the decades following World War II, there was a dramatic reduction in income inequality. So the distance between the top 1% and the rest of us was much lower than it was prior to World War II, and certainly much lower than it is today. You had, and you also had a pattern where average wages tended to rise with average productivity, meaning that as workers were more productive, made more, essentially made more profit for their bosses, they were able to capture, you know, an equal amount. So the lines would sort of go in sync. And then starting in 1973, they basically diverge. And essentially that line about average wages has been flat ever since. So going on 50 years now, and productivity has continued to rise at the same rate that it has since the 1940s. And a huge reason, and so basically that, and so so that productivity is, corporations are making money, their workers are being more productive, but they're not getting paid for their increased productivity. And that money is going into, the owner's pockets.
American workers are holding up their end of the bargain.
Exactly. And so basically and why is that? Well, that's about unions. That's about the decline in the bargaining power of unions. That's deunionization. That's concessions bargaining. That's all that whole package of things that's happened since the 1970s that is responsible.
So you said, maybe I did prepare you for the history of child labor. I don't necessarily think anybody listening in our audience agrees that we should go back to a place where children have to work more to solve our labor problems. Mm-hmm. But what is your sense of the political maybe reasons behind like Wisconsin doing this? And instead of doing this, what are your thoughts, from a policy standpoint of how do we address a tight labor market?
Yeah. So I guess you need to understand that we're talking about a tight labor market, not a labor shortage. That's step one. Mm-hmm. So when employers are saying nobody wants to work anymore, it's always important to add in your head to that phrase, at the wage I want to pay them.
Amen.
Right? Yep. Now, what's really interesting to me about this whole situation is that we hear a lot of rhetoric in society about the magic of free markets and the laws of supply and demand being these sort of ironclad laws that, should be unfettered and should be able to work their magic to sort of ensure prosperity for everyone, except when it comes to wages, the price of labor. So if you have an Econ 101 textbook, the laws of supply and demand suggest that when supply goes down, prices go up. And so if employers behaved like Econ 101 textbooks, then wages would go up, but they're not. And that's because, of this pattern I talked about earlier, where employers have gotten used to wages not rising for the past 50 years, essentially. And that's a lot of that is due to employer power. And so they're used to having that power. And now they're in this situation where the economy does not, the labor market is tight. And that means that workers have a little bit more leverage, but they're not in the mindset of like, oh, now I actually need to pay more.
It would seem to me that flooding the market with children kind of goes hand in hand with not having that union power, because children are not mm-hmm. going to be able to advocate for themselves the way adults will. And so easily exploitable, I would think. Do you think that's playing into this at all?
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of like the strategies are sort of basically they're sort of throwing anything at the wall to see what will stick, except for raising wages. Right. And so, that they'll try, bringing in retirees, bringing in kids, trying to, they might do some bonuses or something like that. But
you're leading right into my next point. They'll bring in children. They'll bring in retirees. They'll bring in contractors rather than actual employees. But, and I know you think we're just talking labor law here, but it's got to be said, who won't they bring in? They won't bring in immigrants. They won't embrace legal immigration. They won't embrace immigration reform, which is so desperately needed at the end of the baby boom to keep our labor markets well supplied and keep the economy from falling apart. At least that's my theory.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously that's part of it. I mean, you know, immigration reform and broad amnesty and citizenship for everyone who's here is a great start that would solve a lot of these problems, and then, you know, combined with increasing wages. But yeah, I think, you know, trying to just find more ways to exploit younger workers is not the answer.
Well, what's your take on this idea that that you fill the market brain fart. What's your take on the effect that this will have on the middle class? So, as you know, so kids of rich families will continue to educate their kids, and families that maybe need their kids in the labor market are going to say, hey, you go work that restaurant job till 11 o'clock at night, and which takes them away from school, from sports, from extracurricular activities. And it seems like it would cause an even further divergence and even more of a dissipating middle class. Do you have any thoughts?
I mean, that, you know, obviously it's too early to tell because it hasn't happened yet. But yes, that seems like a likely course of events we have to understand. I mean, I think that, you know, the way that employing young workers is usually pitched is as a sort of learning experience, a character building experience like that. But this is clear, this sort of extension of the workday is clearly aimed at this, you know, serving this economic purpose, right? It's not a training purpose. And, you know, when you're right that, you know, a lot of kids, you know, that there are the kids of sort of well-off families who are just sort of getting some work experience, you know, getting some pocket money. But there are kids, you know, and particularly given this trend I was talking about stagnating wages, you know, like that is, you know, how do households make ends meet when wages are flat and, you know, the price of gas is going up and the price of food is going up and everything else is going up? Well, one of the solutions is, you know, you have extra money from the kids, you have more female labor participation. You know, some of that is obviously feminism, but some of it is, you know, that you have to have more incomes to make the household budget work. And, you know, so we could easily suspect that the people most likely to, you know, be subject to these more extended hours are people for whom it's more of an economic necessity.
All right, I got one question. So, you know, it was probably a generation or right when I was growing up, it was what I remember, but what I've read about, my mother was a stay-at-home mother. My father, believe it or not, was a professor, and they don't make much money. We know that. But maybe they'd better do better in Canada than they do in America. But we had enough to, you know, for my mom to stay home and take care of the three kids. We all had some jobs, you know, so they didn't have to help us live when we were in high school. We were able to take 2 weeks vacation somewhere in America, you know, in the summertime. I think that's largely disappeared, and I'm 44 years old. To me, that should be the basic minimum that every working class American should be able to deal with. And we know that that exists in so many other countries around the world. How can we get back there, you know, in a perfect world without crazy, you know, people trying to make kids work more? How do we get back there from a policy perspective, maybe from a union perspective, you know?
Yeah. Well, it fundamentally has to do with changing the balance of power and giving workers fighting for more power. And, you know, I think that, you know, we've seen some glimpses of that in recent years. I mean, right now we have the John Deere workers who have rejected their contract for the second time and trying to fight back against sort of two-tier wages and, you know, pension cuts and all that kind of stuff. But the scale is just nowhere near what needs to be happening. So I think, you know, if we get to a, you know, because right now we've got roughly 10% unionization rates in the United States. That's just far too low. And because the thing is that, you know, in the 1960s and stuff like that, when we were more at like a third of the workforce unionized.
What is it in Canada and Germany, just by the way?
So in Canada, current unionization rates are roughly 30%. So roughly three times what they are in the US. And what my book is about is because up until the 1960s, they were virtually identical to what they were in the US, but US kept on declining and Canada was able to sort of stay the course. You know, it's not a great situation. Canadian unions have a lot of problems, but they're much better off than they are in the US. What's important to understand, though, is the way that unions create what a sociologist refers to as moral economies. And that's a sort of fancy term for basically they just set the norms for what people expect a job should entail, right? And so even if you weren't in a unionized job, non-union employers sort of felt the pressure to match the union rates.
Right.
And workers who weren't unionized sort of understood that that was sort of the standard. And in a world where you're at 10%, you just don't have that. Those moral economies have evaporated and the market power has evaporated. So any solution to this problem has to start with rebuilding worker power, and that starts with unions.
Sounds good. Barry Island, thank you so much. This is the Up North Podcast. We'll be right back.
I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountain.